Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Should there be a place in Massachusetts where drug users can go to use illegal substances under a doctor's supervision? That's the question the Massachusetts Medical Society will be addressing this month when it votes on whether or not to recommend a supervised injection facility pilot program in Massachusetts. WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger has been following the story, and she joins us now with more. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so describe these facilities. What exactly do we mean when we say supervised injection facility?
Well, Meghna, let me just say I haven't been to them, so I'm relaying what I've heard from people or seen online. But there are rooms with a series of booths, perhaps, for some privacy or comfortable chairs where you would sit. You'd bring the drugs with you, whatever you were going to do, and they would have a lot of the equipment you might see at a needle exchange, like extra needles if you needed them, alcohol swabs, tourniquets to help you find a vein. There would be a nurse, or in some cases an EMT or a physician assistant, sometimes a doctor, who's there to help and assist in the drug use. They don't inject for you, but they can offer some medical guidance if you're having an abscess or some sort of infection along with it. And in many cases, they would monitor you while you are high. So that might mean oxygen levels, blood pressure. It might mean supplemental oxygen. So that if you start to go out, as you do sometimes in an overdose, they would give you some oxygen to keep you going so that you don't hit that point where they need to blast you with naloxone, which causes this, you know, somewhat violent reversal process. They are typically street level, easy in, easy out, in neighborhoods where you might imagine seeing people who may be homeless or drug users. And sometimes they have detox and treatment in the same building.
I see. So we're talking about a potential pilot program here in Massachusetts, and the Mass Medical Society is going to be voting on this. I mean, why has this question even come up with them? Who's asking them to take this vote?
It's people on the front lines, I guess you might say. So it's people who are active drug users. It's people who are street outreach workers or doctors or nurses who work with addiction patients on a daily basis. And the reason is that they're seeing a big increase in overdose. We have not seen those death numbers start to drop yet. They're still climbing. And they think this is another tool they need to try to reverse that epidemic.
Right. I mean, so as you said, we fully acknowledge that we're in the middle of a terrible epidemic, but also, as you did in your story this morning, you acknowledged that this is incredibly controversial, in part because technically these drugs, use of these drugs is still illegal, right?
Not just use, but
assisting
in the use as well, right? So there are conspiracy laws on the books that say if somebody supports drug use, they can be charged as well. And that's the liability that these medical personnel would face. That's why part of the resolution from the Medical Society is looking for a waiver or an amendment to state law that would relieve them of the liability of being in that room where an illegal activity is taking place.
I see. Now, you've also spoken with people who are concerned that these supervised injection facilities might normalize heroin use.
There's a lot of concern that the message that these rooms would send is that drug use is okay, that we're going to help support your addiction. So here's Norwood Police Chief William Brooks.
To set up a place where addicted people would go and shoot up heroin, to me, sounds crazy. It does feel like we're giving up, like we're throwing our hands up, and I don't think we should do that.
Chief Brooks, Meghna, says the focus really should be on preventing the start of drug use and helping people who are addicted manage that addiction. So he thinks there are a lot of gaps right now in people coming out of detox and using. They're particularly vulnerable to overdose if they haven't been using for a few days. He wants a lot more focus in that area.
And are doctors seeming, is there a division of opinion in the medical community in Massachusetts?
I don't think we've seen any surveys that would tell us that for sure, but this was a unanimous vote by the Board of Trustees at the Medical Society to move this question to what they call their House of Delegates, which is a much larger body of doctors who set policy for this. the organization.
I see. And the full Mass Medical Society is scheduled to take a vote later this month.
Mm-hmm. End of the month.
WBO reporter Martha Biebinger, and we have a link to her report on this at radioboston.org. Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magda.
Well, there is one city in North America that does have a supervised injection site for drug users. It's in Vancouver, Canada. The facility is called Insight, and it opened in 2003, mostly to deal with the HIV and hepatitis C epidemics there. And according to the center's leaders, no one has died from an overdose on site in more than 3.5 million visits. Joining us now to talk about how Insight works is Brandon Marshall. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology at Brown University and has studied this supervised injection facility in Canada and its effects. Brandon Marshall, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, take us back to 2003. Why did Vancouver decide to open this injection facility? What was the main impetus there?
Well, as you mentioned, they were very much in the midst of a hepatitis C and HIV crisis. The new rates of HIV were among some of the highest observed in North America at the time. And in addition, there was a neighborhood, the downtown east side, with a high rate of public injection drug use and unsafe disposal of syringes and other injecting equipment in public spaces. So those were the really primary reasons to embark on a pilot facility in 2003 to open a supervised injection facility in that neighborhood. And of course, some other aims as well were to reduce overdose risk and also to improve access to healthcare and addiction treatment for people who inject drugs.
Right. So we should say right off the bat that this was, it wasn't without controversy in Vancouver, right? That the Canadian federal government did want to shut Insight down. But in 2011, the Canadian High Court voted in a 9-0 decision in favor of Insight staying open. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's correct. So the pilot facility opened in 2003, and we began a comprehensive evaluation that went on for around a decade. And so it was controversial, you're correct, and public opinion and legal opinion was divided. In 2011, the Supreme Court of Canada, as you mentioned, did rule unanimously in favor of keeping the facility open. They were really ruling on the relative benefit of the public health and the public safety outcomes of this facility. And they found, as we have found in our evaluation, that there was no evidence of negative impacts on public safety, but significant benefits to public health. And so closing the facility would actually constitute a violation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so that allowed the facility to remain opened and gave a legal pathway to the subsequent opening of additional facilities in other cities across Canada, which is going on today.
I see. Now, as I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, no one has died from an overdose on site at Insight in more than 3.5 million visits. But more broadly speaking, what effect did you find that the existence of this supervised injection facility had on the population as a whole regarding overdoses, for example?
Mm-hmm. So I was able to participate and led a study that was published in 2011 in The Lancet, which looked at that issue. Did the supervised injection facility have an impact on overdose mortality at the community level? We looked at all of the overdose cases that happened in the year and a half before and the year and a half after the facility opened. And what we found was that in the neighborhood where the facility was operating in the downtown east side, overdose mortality decreased by 35% after the facility opened in that neighborhood, compared to only 9% in the rest of the city of Vancouver, suggesting to us that, in fact, this facility was having a significant positive benefit on reducing overdose mortality at the community level, and suggests that these interventions are effective to reduce overdose, particularly in neighborhoods and cities with high burden of overdose mortality and injection drug use.
Wow, oh, that's a pretty impressive number. And have they kept up that high rate, the difference in overdose mortality to this day? And I guess the reason why I ask is because, you know, for example, here in the United States, there's a huge amount of concern of heroin that's, you know, cut with fentanyl and things. That just the potency of the drugs overall is so much higher that we're seeing so many more deaths.
Yes, and that is being seen in Vancouver as well. There is a significant fentanyl crisis, just like in New England, in Vancouver. In 2015, there were over 700 overdoses that were managed by nurses who supervised in the facility. And again, among those 700 overdose events, many of which were caused by fentanyl, not one fatality. And so that just shows how well overdoses can be managed by health professionals and death prevented in this kind of context. Mm-hmm. And so it remains highly effective even with such toxic and potent opioids on the street like we see in Vancouver and in Boston and New England.
So that's quite an accomplishment. But you know, as a society, not only do we want to reduce the number of fatal overdoses, we'd love to see the abstinence and recovery rate rise and the overall addiction rate drop. I mean, has the presence of a supervised injection site in Vancouver done anything on that front?
That is what I think we have to continue to emphasize in the discussion of these facilities, is that they provide a pathway for folks into treatment and eventual lifelong recovery.
Did they connect people with treatment through the facility?
They do. Okay. They do. We were able to do several studies that looked at that issue. We found that people who used the supervised injection facility were 30% more likely than those that didn't to enter into detox, particularly people who use the facility frequently and also made contact with addictions counselors that work in the facility itself. So it's really designed as a wraparound program that connect people to those services.
Right.
In Vancouver, there's actually a detox facility directly above the injection room itself, so it's co-located with addiction treatment programs, but many other referrals are made to other services. Over 5,000, in fact, were made in 2015 alone, so it's very effective.
Brandon Marshall, we just have a couple seconds, but I do want to ask you one last question. You heard that piece of tape a little earlier from Chief Brooks when I talked to Martha Biebinger, and he was concerned about facilities like this normalizing heroin use, that it was equivalent to society just throwing up its hands. And I imagine other people wouldn't want to see tax dollars used for this. What's your response to that?
Well, I think what we've seen is, in Vancouver anyways, is that this facility did not lead to an increase in drug use or normalization around drug use at all. And subsequent studies also found this to be a very cost-effective use of taxpayer money, preventing HIV infections, which cost over $500,000 in lifetime treatment costs. So, you know, I would say that studies show it is not normalizing drug use and also very effective from an economic point of view as well.
Brandon Marshall is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Brown University, talking to us about a supervised injection facility that's been operating in Vancouver, Canada since 2003. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's the intense feeling, of course, that political polarization right now exists for many reasons. One of them, each side believes the other's wrong and that their own side knows better. But Brown University cognitive scientist Steve Sloman says the truth is, basically, all human beings, all of us, are ignorant. In fact, it's our natural state, he says. But that isn't a terrible thing, because we are terrific at something else. We're terrific at creating communities of knowledge. But how do we stop those communities from battling each other in a way that's detrimental to us all? Well, Sloman delves into all of this in his new book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. And he joins us now. Steve Sloman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's great to have you. So we're all ignorant. And I'll throw myself into that group, of course. Why? Why do you say that?
Well, you can throw me into that group, too. I say it in part because there's a lot of work showing that people can't answer a lot of basic questions. You know that 25% of Americans don't know whether the Earth revolves around the sun or the sun revolves around the Earth.
In 2017?
This study was done a few years ago.
Okay.
But in the modern age, that's right. And it's not just true of Americans. It's true of people all around the world.
Wow. Okay. But you say it's more fundamental than that. I mean, you write that ignorance is our natural state, and that exists for a reason. And why?
Yeah. So the real claim isn't that people are stupid. I mean, people are relatively ignorant, but the real idea is that people think they understand things better than they do. And this has been demonstrated in the psychological laboratory by a great psychologist at Yale named Frank Kyle and his students, who showed that if you ask people to explain simple objects like how toilets work or how even ballpoint pens work, they find themselves unable to do so. And in fact, what asking them to explain does is it bursts their bubble of understanding so that they rate their understanding as lower than they thought it was. So people admit they lived in an illusion of knowledge by virtue of trying to explain how things work and failing.
Mm. So that goes hand in hand, though, with what makes us such a wildly successful species, one of the things. And that is that, yes, we have this illusion of knowledge, but exists in part because, you know, as you write, we have communal knowledge that we've as organisms, we've been able to outboard expertise in so many different areas that it allows us as a species to accomplish a lot, right?
Exactly. So the idea is that we live in this illusion of knowledge because we confuse others' knowledge for our own. And the reason we have trouble distinguishing the source of knowledge is because we're all in it together. There's a division of cognitive labor, so we bring our own little bit of expertise to the table, and everyone else brings their own little bit of expertise, so that together there's a lot of expertise, there's a lot of knowledge. But the confusion has to do with what we know relative to what others know, and we sort of take credit for the community's knowledge.
Yeah, so there's a profoundly positive influence or impact of this communal knowledge. We've been talking about it in terms of, or I've been hearing you talk about it so far in terms of like communal knowledge and expertise, but there's also communal belief.
Yes.
And communal ignorance as well that all gets lumped in here.
Yeah, so I think it's important to distinguish issues like how toilets and ballpoint pens work from questions like what political policy we should pursue. So in the first case, there's general agreement about what is right, what ground truth is. So we can appeal to our community, and we tend to agree about who the experts are, right? So in the case of a toilet, there are plumbers who are experts. But when it comes to political policy, it's not so clear. So the real problem we point to is what you might think of as contagious understanding, mm-hmm. right? We get a sense of understanding by virtue of the fact that the people around us have a sense of understanding. But if their sense of understanding depends on the sense of understanding of the people around them, then we could have a whole community that thinks it understands how things work, when in fact it's a house of cards, when in fact there's no real fundamental basis for that belief.
Yeah, I mean, so it provides a sort of social cohesion, but one that could be easily undermined if, again, as you said, it doesn't have any basis in fact. So, I mean, what are the implications for democracy, then, if we're in a way sort of hardwired for this?
Yes. No, that's a good question. I do think it means that democracy is not perfectly consistent with the way minds are built, which, you know, is not necessarily a knock on democracy. I'm with Churchill that, you know, democracy is the worst system except for all the others. I don't think that the reason to live in a democratic society is because it's consistent with the way the mind works. But it does suggest, I think, that we should perhaps rely on expertise more than we sometimes do. Look, societies differ a lot in the extent to which they depend on expertise. One issue we take up in the book is what's often called direct democracy. So in, for instance, California, they have referenda all the time in which they allow individual citizens to vote on complex issues. And, you know, the world is just too complex for most people to understand, or at least for anybody to understand everything. And I really think it's a mistake to put really important decisions about complex matters in the hands of people who have other things to do with their time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but see, I guess part of my mind right now is stuck on this, the double-edged sword of the human brain, right? Because on the one hand, what you're saying is this basic hardwiring and also sort of social hardwiring that we have has allowed us to put a people on the moon, right? It's allowed
exactly.
us to invent the iPhone. It's allowed us to do all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it produces these pathways where we get these collective beliefs that are very, very, very hard
to unwind from. So you've also done some experiments on how we can actually maybe gently start getting people to realize that they know less than they really do, and what effect that might have on these hardened sort of circles of collective belief that we have.
Right. Well, in some sense, I've already told you the procedure. So
yeah.
Kyle did this work on what he called the illusion of explanatory depth using everyday objects. We did it with political policies. So we asked people how well they understood, you know, various issues like cap and trade of carbon emissions, whether there should be unilateral sanctions on Iran, those kinds of things. And then we asked them to explain, and they found themselves unable to for the most part. And then again, we asked them to understand whether they understood the issue, and we found, like Kyle did, that we had punctured their illusion of understanding. But the other thing we did was ask them about their attitudes, how confident they felt about their attitudes towards the various policies. And we also punctured their confidence to some degree. So by virtue of explaining or trying to explain, trying and failing to explain how the policy worked, people became less confident, less extreme, less polarized.
So why do you think that is? I mean, what's the difference between having someone explain why they think, I don't know, clean water regulation works or doesn't versus having them defend their position?
Right. So, you know, we tend not to explain, or at least the vast majority of people tend not to engage in processes of explanation. What we do instead is we talk about our values. We talk about our community. We talk about what we think should be right and wrong, which is a discussion about how we relate to the policy. It's not actually a discussion about the policy itself. So what we propose is that if you can get the conversation to change to be one about how the policy will lead to consequences. That is a discussion that has nothing to do with you, right? That's about the policy itself on its own terms. Then you're going to find that people engage in a little more analysis. They're more open to compromise. And maybe we'll find some common ground to talk together if we talk in those terms.
And so how do you think that we might be able to practically inject this sort of way of engaging with information and policy in real life? I mean, should people like me be asking different kind of questions when I have experts or politicians on?
It's your responsibility, Magna. Absolutely.
We got to start somewhere.
Look, I do think that the answer is not in the place that most people jump to, which is simple education, right? So we're talking about a basic property of mind. We're talking about how people work at the most fundamental level. And I don't think you can simply educate people to operate and think in an entirely different way. I mean, I'm not arguing against the value of education in general, of course. I'm just saying that it's not going to be a silver bullet for this particular problem. So, yeah, we have to learn to reach outside our bubbles, right? We have to learn to talk to people in a respectful way. But more than anything, I think we have to try to separate the issues from our own interests. And I think we have to do it by changing the norms of discourse.
That sounds so hard to me, because separating the issues from our own interests it seems entirely opposed to the fundamental human characteristics that got us here to begin with, that like we form collective groups of knowledge and interests, right?
Absolutely. But look, we're stuck. I mean, American politics, and not just American politics, is really stuck, and it might be getting worse. So it is a hard problem. It's a really hard problem. And as I said, I'm not pretending to offer a silver bullet, but we have to try.
Well, Steve Sloman, hear, hear, for trying. Every step counts, if you ask me. He's the editor-in-chief of the journal Cognition. He's a professor at Brown University, and his new book is The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. It's an absolutely fascinating read. Steve Sloman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump came out with a strong response this afternoon to yesterday's suspected chemical weapons attack in Syria, which reportedly killed more than 100, including many children. Standing in the Rose Garden alongside King Abdullah of Jordan, the president said that the attack crossed a line.
It crossed a lot of lines for me. When you kill innocent children, innocent babies, little babies, with a chemical gas that is so lethal, people were shocked to hear what gas it was. That crosses many, many lines, beyond the red line, many, many lines.
That was just this afternoon at the White House. Earlier today at the UN Security Council, Nikki Haley, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, took an even harder line.
When the United Nations consistently fails in its duty to act collectively, there are times in the life of states that we are compelled to take our own action. For the sake of the victims, I hope the rest of the council is finally willing to do the same.
Well, joining me now with some analysis is Max Abrams. He's a professor of political science at Northeastern University and an expert on international security and terrorism. Professor Abrams, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your reaction to what we heard the president say just this afternoon? I mean, is he signaling a major rethinking of U.S. policy on Syria?
I mean, this is really, really striking. His language on Syria has completely changed. Remember, during the campaign, he tried to differentiate himself from Hillary Clinton by saying, you know, he's not a regime change guy. He doesn't support, you know, the rebels. He wants to work with Russia together against the terrorists, etc. And now he seems to have done a very quick about-face. And it seems to be driven primarily by, you know, these major international humanitarian concerns, because the use of chemical weapons is understood all over the world as a qualitative escalation. And so now the UN is debating what to do about it. Of course, this isn't the first time. There was also a major chemical attack in 2013 in East Ghouta. But the Russians blocked a UN resolution. They've blocked 7 UN resolutions. And so I expect Russia to block this resolution, too, at which point the U.S. may have to try to go around it.
As Nikki Haley indicated earlier today. But Professor Abrams, let me ask you. I mean, obviously, the president was feeling, like many people are, a huge amount of emotion about the images coming out of Syria. There's no doubt about that. But in the same press conference in the Rose Garden today, he said, when he was pressed on what would the U.S. do in response, he said, I'm not saying I'm doing anything one way or another, but I'm certainly not going to be telling you, being the reporter. So he was nonspecific to that answer.
I mean, if we know anything about Trump, it's that he is the solution to everything up his sleeve. You know, not just Islamic State, but also presumably Syria. No, I mean, the truth is that that Syria is a really tough situation. There really aren't, you know, many good guys. We wanted to side with the rebels. We looked, you know, for moderate rebel opposition under Obama, and we really just didn't find them in large numbers. The truth of the matter is that the insurgency, or whatever you want to call it, has been taken over by al-Qaeda types. The area that was bombed, Idlib, is absolutely teeming with terrorists. And so if we remove Assad, that will create a power vacuum, which will breathe even more life into these al-Qaeda-type players. On the other hand, what is the president supposed to do? Just stand by when there's this imagery of, you know, this regime indiscriminately gassing the population, including children? And so everybody feels very emotional about this issue, but intellectually, when you really understand how bad it is there and what the alternatives are, it remains unclear how we should proceed.
Right. Well, I mean, the president said also today that his attitude towards Syria and Assad has changed very much. And as we heard earlier, He said that what's happened has crossed many, many, many lines beyond a red line, officially putting him further than the Obama administration ever went. Max Abrams, professor of political science at Northeastern University, thank you so much. Hope to have you back as we'll see what develops here with the United States and Syria.
Talk to you soon.
Well, finally today, let's shift gears and talk about sports with Bill Littlefield, because it is Wednesday and he's host of NPR's Only a Game. Hello, Bill.
Hello, Magna.
So let's start with college ball, because the University of North Carolina won the NCAA men's college basketball tournament on Monday. Your quick take on that?
It was an ugly game. Just looked almost record setting in terms of fouls committed in the second half. Not quite, but ugly game. But North Carolina has lots of fans, and I'm sure they're very, very happy that they have achieved what the newspaper writers and commentators are calling redemption.
Yeah.
I'm always very unhappy with the use of that word in that context, but there you are.
Oh, well, but that provides us with a nice segue, because now the NCAA has said they will, quote, reluctantly lift a ban on the state of North Carolina that had stopped the state from hosting any championship games this year. The ban, which was instated 6 months ago, was in response to House Bill 2 or HB 2, the so-called bathroom bill in North Carolina. Did the NCAA bill make the right call in lifting the ban?
Well, I don't think they did, because it seems to me that the replacement bill is a change in procedure and not in principle, and it is not at all effective at protecting transgender people and others who were inconvenienced and otherwise made victims by the first law.
I mean,
it's only a question of who gets to make laws as we go forward,
right.
And it's not going to protect anybody.
I was just going to jump in here and say that the NCAA pretty much seems like they're acknowledging as much, because in their statement, they say the law has, quote, minimally achieved a situation where they believe the NCAA championships may be conducted.
Yeah, and I don't think it's even
aiming high.
No, that's right. I think they're saying, well, you know what? They did something, and so rather than continue to inconvenience the people in North Carolina who'd like to have our events transpire on their, you know, in their venues, we're going to go ahead and do it. If you want to give the NCAA the benefit of the doubt, I suppose you could say they hope that by doing this, they will encourage further rational procedures regarding this law and others.
That's optimistic.
Yeah, I'm sometimes optimistic.
Yeah. Well, let's stick with college ball here, but a different kind of story, because Patrick Ewing will start immediately as the new head coach at Georgetown. He'd been an assistant NBA coach for 15 years and obviously had a stellar pro career even before that. But he's got, of course, a complicated history with Boston. Went to high school in Cambridge, but rejected offers to play for BC and BU. And instead, he went to Georgetown from 1981 to 85. So remind us of how Boston had reacted to that.
Well, I think Boston reacted in a very parochial way and
very
said,
Boston
hey,
way.
He's a local kid and he's 7 feet tall. How come he doesn't stick around and help Boston College win an NCAA championship? It's also important, I think, to say that Patrick Ewing, upon assuming his new position as head coach at Georgetown, said, hey, my 4 years at Georgetown were four of the best years of my life. He made the right choice for him. And he's the only one who should be making that sort of choice, just as people leaving high school these days and choosing colleges are the only ones who should be making those choices. It's great that he has this job. No one in my knowledge, to my knowledge, has ever prepared more fully for a full, you know, head coaching job than Patrick Ewing. And we have people as reliable as Larry Bird saying in the past that Patrick Ewing is a very good coach and an intelligent fellow who's certainly capable of imposing order and discipline on a college basketball team.
Great. Well, good for Ewing, I have to say. And sorry, Boston, if you're going to treat people badly, don't expect them to come back.
Well, Boston wasn't the only place where he was treated badly. He was treated badly Wherever Georgetown played, people held up insulting banners and shouted insulting things at him. And I think that's part of the racism that unfortunately still is apparent within sports and beyond.
Well, let's talk about the Celts real quickly, because they face the Cleveland Cavaliers tonight in a game that could determine who takes the lead as the top seed in the Eastern Conference.
Another game, right, Magna?
Just another game.
I love that when they say that.
One of these days they're going to surprise us and say there's something other than
this
just another
This is not
game.
Just another game, right?
I mean, but what's at stake here?
Well, first place in the division is at stake, and home court advantage through the playoffs, not quite, because there's a little bit more regular season to play after tonight. But certainly the team coming out on top would have the running start at that. And home court advantage matters. You know, the Celtics have been magnificent at home this year. So it would be a very nice thing to beat Cleveland tonight and go on to finish first.
But it's just another game.
Yes, just another game.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs each Saturday on WBUR at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And you have the delight of listening to him here on Wednesdays on Radio Boston. Bill, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.